This is a story by Brian Doyle. It's called King of the Losers. My sister and her boyfriend have two kids, girls, ages 4 and 1. The kids are total sweethearts, and the big one is wicked smart and can read already. My sister is wicked smart, too, but she has major mental thunderstorms, and the social service has come 3 times to check on the kids. The boyfriend is messed up, too, but his problem is simply that he is the biggest loser ever. The best job he ever had was delivering pizza, which lasted 2 whole days before they fired him and docked all his pay, which tells you all you need to know. His job these days, as far as I can tell, is stealing money from countertops and mailboxes. My other sister and I used to leave dollar bills on the kitchen counter and bet how fast he would palm them. His all-time record was 19 seconds. If there really was a God, this guy would be working in a prison laundry. But there's clearly no God, or not much of one, because my sister is always talking how much she loves the guy, but we see him for what he is, which is King of the Losers. I would beat him up, but what's the point? My sister would just fawn over the bruises, and he would be so mortified that a teenager hammered him that he would be even meaner to his kids, and I love those kids. Anyway, the point of my story is the 4th time the social services came to the house, which is a total pit. My sister isn't capable of maintaining the house, and the loser is too lazy. They don't pay rent or anything on the house. The loser got it from his uncle as a tax dodge. For a long time, my mom and dad and other sister and I would go over on the weekends and clean up just to keep the kids from living in filth. But my dad quit going over because he always ends up crying or my sister screaming at him, and my mom is all busy with the courts trying to get custody of the kids, and my other sister moved away and got a crew cut and changed her name. So I am the only one going over there lately. So the other day, I drive over to clean the bathroom and kitchen, which are the absolute crucial places to clean. But when I get there, the social service truck is parked in front of the house, and I get the willies, because 3 times is the limit for social service, and the 4th time is business. I can hear the loser yelling and my sister hysterical, so I go around back and find the girls on the swings, the big one pushing the little one. I ask them how long the social service has been here, and the older one says, like, only 2 minutes, because she and her sister just came out, and she remembered to buckle the baby into the swing like I showed her. I say, that is excellent baby management, and they can swing for exactly 1 minute while I check the score, and I lean in the back door and hear the calm, reasonable voices of the social service, and the loser yelling that they are his kids, damn it, and this is fascism, and where's the warrant, and he knows his rights, and this is a police state, and etc. I listen for my sister, but now I don't hear her at all, which is a bad sign. When she's really flipped out, she shuts down all systems and erects deflector shields and rocks herself in the closet. So I realize this is doomsday. Social service has come to take the kids, and while I totally support the idea of social service and how the state is responsible for children from untenable homes, I also know these are sort of my kids too, so I gather up the girls, and we cut across the neighbors' yards and slip into my car like secret agent spies, me carrying the baby like a football, which she thinks is funny, and we drive away very quietly and go 5 towns before we stop and get some fries and try to think this puppy through. My dad is a math teacher, and he taught us that major problems are best solved by breaking them into components. So I calculate details first, money and gas and food and diapers, and the chances of the social service coming after me or calling my parents or maybe even putting the loser in jail, and I conclude we're screwed, especially as R.E. diapers. Right about then, there's a ketchup incident, and the baby starts to cry, and the manager is staring at us, so we retreat to the car. But as soon as we are on the road, the 4-year-old tells me the baby needs to be changed. She can tell. and we stop and get diapers and then stop at a park where I change the baby on the grass because the bathroom is locked with a huge padlock that I can't get off even after using a tire iron to break it off. I mean, why lock a public bathroom, you know? The point of a public bathroom is that it's public, right? Talk about your social services. Finally, we get back on the road and head toward the beach, figuring in winter there won't be anybody there, and we can haul up and take stock of the situation. "We go to the beach," says the four-year-old. Her name is Ari. "You know this road?" I say. "One time our car broke here," she says. What a shock, I think, the Losermobile breaking down. "It was fun," she said. "We saw fish. Daddy had beer." "Did he?" "Beer is important." "Is that so?" "Daddy says so." "Okay." "Baby sleeping." "Good," I say. "Are you tired, Ari?" "I never tired. Sleeping for babies." "Okay." "We go swimming?" "Too cold. We'll go swimming in summer." "Is summer tomorrow?" "A few weeks." "Can I have more fries?" "You can eat the rest of the bag." "Thank you, Kenny." "You're welcome, Ari." When we get to the beach, we park behind the old bathhouse they are still fixing 2 years after they started because there was a huge scandal with the money. It was in the papers. This reminds me of some of the loser's greatest hits. Like one time, my other sister caught him with our dad's wallet in his hand, and the loser says he was checking dad's birth date. Or the time the guy across the street got tired of the loser going through his mailbox for checks, and he put a monster rat trap in his mailbox, and it nearly tore the loser's fingers off, and the loser told us he hurt his hand fighting off a mugger. Or the time my other sister caught him taking the money she left for Ari to get snacks at preschool. That time she slapped him good, and he cocked his fist, and I stood up fast, and he backed off. That was the only time she ever lost it with the loser. She left home 4 days later. I check Ari and see she's asleep too, and I gauge the immediate future. I have a bank card and can hit the machine for $300, the daily maximum. Food we can get, diapers we have, and there's plenty of gas. I try to think about the components of the problem where a guy 16 years old is totally on the lam with a child age 4 and a child age 1. But does not compute comes up on the mental screen. So I listen to the radio for a while until the baby wakes up crying. The baby waking up wakes up Ari, and Ari says, "The baby is hungry." She can tell. "What do we feed her?" "Animal crackers when she crying." "Do we have any?" "In my pink coat." "Where's your pink coat?" "At home." I suggest to Ari that maybe more fries will hold the baby over until we get some crackers, and that going back to the house is not a great idea. But she says the baby hates fries, and that she, Ari, loves her coat, and also the baby's binky is on the grass by the swings, and without binky, she will never stop crying. So I put the car in gear and ease out from behind the old bathhouse, but just then the Losermobile fishtails right in front of us, and the loser jumps out, yelling, and runs right at us before I can hit the brakes, and we hit him medium hard, and he goes head over heels right over the car, like my dad says a deer did when he was driving my mom to the hospital to have my first sister. The way my dad tells it is that the deer crushed the top of the car, so he and my mom had to drive to the hospital, crouched down in the front seat, peering at the road, but that this was actually a good thing because a few inches the other way, and that would have been the end of my mom and dad and sister. "Daddy flying," says Ari. "Dumbo," says the baby, clear as day. I grab the tire iron as I get out of the car, just in case. But it turns out there's no need. The loser is totally out cold with his face in a puddle. So I break the problem down into components. What I need primarily at the moment is Animal Crackers and Binky, so I drag the loser out of the puddle and fold him into the trunk and lock it and head down the road looking for a store. We find one, but they don't have Animal Crackers, and the baby won't eat the ginger snaps I get on sale for $1.99, a huge bag. How they can make money selling such a big bag for so little money is a mystery to me. But then we do find a grocery store with a whole wall of Animal Crackers. It's like the mother load of Animal Crackers. So I buy 20 boxes just to be safe. These are $2.09 each. Ari and I open two boxes and count the crackers. There are 20 in each box. So I point out to Ari that the crackers are like 10 cents each, see? Whereas the ginger snaps are about a penny each, the bag being the size of a puppy chow bag. She just don't like the gingers, Kenny. Okay, honey. By this time, the loser is awake and yelling and banging in the trunk, so we get back on the road. Daddy mad, says Ari. He's not a happy man, I say. He's yelling. I hear him. You give Daddy a time out. I did, Ari. Where is Mommy? She's home. We go home? Where exactly is your pink coat, Ari? Behind the back door. I hang it on the nail. Mommy says it belongs on the nail, not on the floor. We'll go get your coat. I love my coat. And we'll get the Binky. She loved Binky. When we get near the house, I tell Ari to duck down like a secret agent spy and guard the spaceship while I get the magic coat, and she says, "Aye, Captain," and I slip back to the house through the backyards and find the coat right on the nail where she says it is. That Ari is the coolest kid ever. She learned to read by figuring out the letters on the backs of the books at our house, and then she started reading comic strips in the papers, and pretty soon she was reading captions on news photographs. She was the one who told me about the scandal with the money with the bathhouse, because the word bathhouse fascinated her, and she wanted to know why there were certain houses that were only for taking baths. I listen for my sister, but I don't hear anything, so I scribble a note that the kids are okay and the loser is not in jail yet, and hang it on the nail and slip back to the car. Ari says the loser has been yelling and banging so loud that the baby started to cry, and so she, Ari, gave the baby more Animal Crackers. That is excellent, Ari, I say. Good baby management. Daddy hungry too, she says. Did he tell you that? Yes, he did, Kenny. Can you hear him through the seat? Through the hole. What hole? The elbow pillow hole, she says, and she shows me that when you fold down the centerpiece of the back seat, there is indeed a circular hole the size of a baseball between the trunk and the back seat. I guess for ventilation. As soon as Ari shows me the hole, though, the loser starts yelling through it, so we close it up again. Can I give Daddy an animal cracker? Asks Ari. Better save those for the baby. Ginger snap? Okay, just one, though. She waits a minute for him to stop yelling, and then she opens the pillow real fast and pops a ginger snap into it and then slams it shut again before he can start yelling, and we get back on the road. I figure the best thing overall is to keep moving. My dad says the coolest thing about mathematics is not that there are fixed and immutable answers to problems. This is a popular misconception about the subtle genius and deep attraction of mathematics, but it's the other way around. Nothing is fixed and secure. All things are in motion at all times. So mathematics is actually a living language for describing where things are at any particular moment, but that any statement of absolute truth is intrinsically and by nature inaccurate. Which is why politics, for example, is theater and not science. My mom gets impatient when he rambles along in this vein, because she says there are some immutable truths, and the point of life is to grapple with what is rather than go all moony and flabby about subjectivity and relativity. One time, when my mom was having a particularly bad day with my first sister, my other sister deliberately asked for an example of an immutable truth just to set mom off. And mom, totally taking the bait, said, for example, the fact that your sister is addicted to a selfish and abusive wastrel, which then became a catchphrase for me and my other sister as, R.E., the loser. It seems to me that we will be hardest to spot in a sea of cars, so we take the expressway and then the Belt Parkway around the city because there is a circus or something downtown and we don't want to get stuck. As we go over the bridge, Ari looks for elephants for the baby, but doesn't see any. When we get out in the country, we stop for lunch, and Ari says we better wear the baby out before her nap, otherwise she won't nap more than an hour and we'll be all cranky. So we spend a couple hours at a park by a river where there's an excellent playground with wood chips under the monkey bars and swings. Wood chips underneath play structures seem like an excellent idea to me, although Ari says you can get splinters from them if you fall the wrong way. Her friends Melanie and Melody got splinters from the wood chips at school, but teacher took the splinters out right away, and Melanie and Melody both got cool Band-Aids and cookies. Also, Melody was faking a little. When we get back to the car, I see that the loser has kicked dents in the trunk from the inside, and the car looks like it has hives. This is not good, because the last thing my mom and dad need at this point is to worry about the car. But to be honest, I can understand how the loser would be a little frustrated with his day so far. Not to mention, he is wet from the puddle. So I go to give him a ginger snap through the hole, but he tries to grab my hand, and I have to hit the fingers with a tire iron. I figure this is as good a time as any to have a talk with him, and I tell him through the hole that matters are in hand, we have diapers and animal crackers, and the kids are not with social services, which is where they would be if he was captain of the ship. "Aye, captain," says Ari. The girls each say hello, Daddy, to the hole, and Ari tries to give him another ginger snap, but he tries to grab her hand also, and I have to crack him again with a tire iron. One thing about the loser is he is not the brightest star in the sky. My dad says there are saloon doors with more intellectual capacity than the petty hoodlum with whom his daughter has chosen to cohabit, which is a good example of the way my dad speaks. Before we get back on the road, we stop at a grocery, and I hit the machine for the daily maximum and really stock up this time. Animal crackers, on sale for $1.89, milk, sandwiches, diapers, sleeping bags, water, bananas, because who doesn't like bananas? And those little oranges that are so easy to peel, you know, the kind that only arrive in stores in winter. Ari says they are from Spain, but I am not sure. "Can we go to Spain?" she asks. "Someday." "Can we go tomorrow?" "We'll see." "Does that mean no?" "No." "We should get beer," says Ari. "Beer is important." This is actually not a bad idea, although technically I cannot buy beer. But the checker is clearly no older than me, and one thing I have learned from my mom is that if you carry a persona with absolute conviction, you are that person. So we choose beer cans that will fit through the hole, and I exude confidence, and the checker checks them through without comment. In fact, she doesn't even look at me, and doesn't say anything except, "Paper or plastic?" When we get back to the car, the sun is going down, and we take a vote on where to go. Ari and I vote for driving into the sun, just because, and the baby gets all excited and says, "Yub, yub." So we figure that's unanimous. We each have an animal cracker to celebrate the advent of the voyage, as my dad would say, and we give the loser a beer through the hole. I suggest to Ari that every time we cross a state line, we give the loser a beer, and she says okay, but we should give him two beers when we cross into the biggest states of all. It's a mark of how cool Ari is that she knows Texas and California are the biggest states. You can't tell me there are a lot of four-year-olds who know their states that well. I point out that technically Alaska is a huge state also, and she agrees that Alaska should count. So off we go. That story was called King of the Losers. It was written by Brian Doyle, and it's in his collection of short stories called Bin Laden's Bald Spot, published in 2011 by Red Hen Press. Brian Doyle is the editor of Portland Magazine, published at the University of Portland. Here's a short story, kind of a fable, really. It's so universal. So I'll tell you at the end who wrote it and where they live. The Committee. There was once a man who bought a donkey and found, afterwards, that he'd been cheated. The beast was stupid. He went to the judge, and the judge in turn summoned the vendor, who told him he'd had little experience with donkeys. If, he went on, the judge could show the donkey lacked intelligence, then he'd return the money. Otherwise, the sale should remain valid. Finally, the judge, after a good deal of thought, chose to form a committee which would decide whether the donkey was stupid or not. The committee looked thoroughly into the donkey's case. Several sessions were held, but the members only argued among themselves, and a lot of money was spent. The chairman thought it necessary to summon the vendor before the committee, and the vendor's testimony covered the donkey's family tree, behavior, preferences, and date of birth. Still, though, the committee couldn't reach a verdict, and the man who'd bought the donkey was growing tired of taking the beast back and forth each morning to attend the meetings. At last, the committee submitted a proposal to the parties concerned, who gave it their full approval, except that the buyer objected to one feature. If, he said, just a single vet was called on, as proposed, to give the donkey a checkup, the opinion of that one vet might not come down on his side of the question. He asked, accordingly, that a committee of vets be set up to run the checks. Even then, though, the vets disagreed among themselves and couldn't reach a unanimous verdict. The checkups were repeated, but failed to bring the desired result. Word of the case reached the news agencies and press, who had a field day, publishing a picture of the donkey on their front pages. Soon everyone knew about the donkey. Many of the journalists took the buyer's side, and they launched a campaign against fraud. This kind of thing, they maintained, smacked of corruption, and they warned of the evil effects on society and of how it would put honest dealing and mutual trust in jeopardy. One young journalist, who covered the case especially well, was promoted to be chief editor. People began to take a close interest in the case, which now eclipsed all other stories. They were divided, some supporting the buyer and others the vendor, who couldn't, they said, be blamed for the donkey's lack of intelligence. Meanwhile, newspaper sales reached an all-time peak. You couldn't find one after 9 a.m. The intellectuals got involved, too, and started reading books about donkeys. The buyer grew very tired of it all. He was spending most of his time taking the donkey from the vet's clinic to the stable, and he even had to borrow money to pay for the medical tests and the food and transportation. Finally, he went to the judge, explaining that he was tired out and needed a quick solution. The time had come, the judge realized, for the police to be called in, and so the case was referred to them, and they, after due consideration, told the judge there were two possible solutions. The first was to send all the medical records abroad for final arbitration. The second, that one of the parties to the dispute should back down. The judge rejoiced at this, applauding the wisdom of the decision. He summoned the two parties accordingly to attend what he supposed would be the final session. By this time, Word had reached the press and news agencies, who gathered outside the courtroom, together with all the other people who'd come to hear the verdict. The judge informed both parties of the police decision and told them they must choose. The two said nothing for a time. Then the vendor asked if he might see the donkey. The judge agreed to this and instructed that the beast be brought in. The vendor looked at the donkey, then, seeing how much heavier and stronger it had grown over the past months, he told the judge he'd take it back and return the money. The judge, in his relief, leaped from his seat and hugged the buyer. People couldn't believe it, that the vendor had actually agreed to take the donkey back and refund the money. Vendor and donkey walked from the courtroom to the applause of the people, to where hundreds of flashing cameras awaited them. At that, the vendor whispered in the donkey's ear, "Welcome back, my dear donkey," he said. "I swear, you're the only sane creature in this town." That story was called The Committee. It was written by Abdallah al-Nasser of Saudi Arabia, and it's published in his collection of stories, The Tree and Other Stories. Here's a story by Susan Steinberg. It's called Cowboys. There are some who say I did not kill my father. Not technically, they mean. But the ones who say I did not kill my father are the ones who want to have sex with me. They say I did not kill my father because they cannot have sex with a woman who killed. What I mean is they cannot have sex with a woman who carries, like all women carry, an unbearable weight. So they mix me another drink, they laugh, they say, "You did not kill your father." What they think they believe and what they truly believe, two different things. I am still able to lie there nights, but I am unable to do much more than that. Meaning, I am still able to lie there nights, but I am unable to stick around in the mornings. Meaning, I am unable to lie there pretending I want what it is certain women want. Because of this and because of that. And I cannot pretend to be anything other than the result of this and that. When the doctor called at 4 a.m., waked me at 4 a.m. from a dream I can almost remember, something about chasing dogs in a field, something about a fence. He introduced himself as the doctor. He said, "I am Dr. such and such," in this uptight voice, this doctor's voice. And I laughed and said, "You're who?" I said, "Who is this?" My brother was also on the line. And my brother was in Boston, and the doctor was in Baltimore, and I was in a place called Warrensburg, Missouri. I was in Warrensburg, Missouri for a job I was trying to quit. When I mention Warrensburg, Missouri, people say, "Where the fuck is that?" I tell them there are cowboys. I tell them there are tornadoes that can carry your house across the state. There are brown recluse spiders, I tell them, in every corner of every room. It's a shithole, I tell them. And there I was in it, trying my best to sleep right through it, a doctor telling me at 4 a.m. to please be serious. I was not always serious, and somehow the doctor already knew this. Knew perhaps because I laughed when he said he was the doctor. Or he knew, perhaps, because my brother told him I would not be serious. Or he knew, perhaps, because when he told me to kill my father, I laughed again. He did not, of course, use the word kill. He had another word, a series of words, a more technical way of wording. The doctor sounded exhausted, and my brother sounded exhausted. My brother and his wife had a 1-year-old boy. The boy was always crying in the background, My brother was always saying, shh. My brother always had circles under his eyes. They were bluish, the circles, and they made him look beaten down. You look like Dad, I said to him once. Fuck you, he said to me more than once. We were no longer kids, and this was a serious matter. The doctor had been up all night. Trying to save your father, he said. To no avail, he said. And I wondered at the word avail, wondered if the doctor got to be a doctor because of whatever it was he had that made him use the word avail. I wanted something to eat. I wanted to run downstairs in the massive house I was renting in Warrensburg, Missouri, and root through the refrigerator for the leftovers. The leftovers were in takeout containers, and I wanted to bring them up to my bed, switch on the TV, move into that blue-lit space. The doctor said my father had flatlined several times, and I knew the word flatlined from my ex, who had flatlined 3 times when we were together. He had flatlined my ex because he was an addict, and being an addict, as it turns out, will make one flatline. After the first flatline, my mother, a nurse, said, he'll never be the same. But he was the same, as it turned out, because he flatlined again. After the third flatline, we broke up. I'd like to say we broke up because I'd had enough of his flatlining. But really, he broke up with me for another woman. A thinner woman. A paler woman. The veins too vivid through her face. And she eventually flatlined too. And she eventually died from this. But he did not. He became a firefighter. I moved to Warrensburg, Missouri. The whole world just went on. The doctor said my father would be a vegetable, and upon hearing this word, I imagined a plate. I imagined vegetables on this plate. One does not want to imagine this. One wants to imagine one's father spinning through a field, arms spread, something dynamic like that, even something totally made up like that. My father would never have spun through a field. He was mad, yes, but he was not that kind of mad. He was not that kind of happy mad. He was the other kind. He was ferocious. And besides, what field? And where? It was Baltimore where we all were, before we all weren't. And there were no fields, just streets of nothing and more nothing. Just my ex knocking on some boarded-up door. Just me waiting in the car. But here, where I was now, where I am no longer, Warrensburg, Missouri, there were fields. The doctor said my name. He said, please. My brother said my name. I had a decision to make. I had a serious decision to make, because I was the oldest kid. Though, as stated, I was not the most serious of the two. And my serious brother, with his serious boy screaming his head off in some dark room in their serious city, was waiting for me to do the right thing. This was years ago, and I'm telling you this because the story came to me today, just for no real reason, just because I happened to see a guy digging around in the trash, and I was like, you again. I was like, get out of there. Get out of my head, I was like. And I'm telling you this because some have been wondering why I am the way I am, which is to say a whirlwind, which is to say a lot of things. I could not at first kill my father. I at first said no. I said, not as long as he's still breathing. But he isn't breathing, said the doctor. Not technically, he said. The doctor sounded fed up, and not fed up with the limitations of science, and not fed up with the limitations of the human body, meaning not fed up how I was. A man I knew in Warrensburg, Missouri, a man I knew from the job I needed to quit, had been bitten by a brown recluse. He'd rolled over it one night in bed and got bitten in the ass. When he told me the story, I laughed. I was like, "Why were you naked?" He was like, "Wrong question." Because he was trying to tell me the bite dissolved the skin on his ass. Because he was trying to tell me that this just wasn't right. The technical term is necrotized. The point is, I was not always serious. No, the point is, we're limited. The doctor said, a machine is making him breathe. He did not use the word machine. I said I would have to call my mother to get her advice. And my brother said, don't be a dumbass. And the doctor sighed in that way that the assholes I have dated since sigh when they do not get what they want. Like the restaurant is out of chicken wings. Like the beer is flat. Like I'm trying to convince them I'm a terrible person. Like I'm already stepping into my skirt. Like I'm already reaching for the doorknob, a bigger whore than they want me to be. They sigh, and it applies pressure to the woman. And the woman is then supposed to give them what they want. Which is to say, the woman is then supposed to perform. Which is to say, the woman is then supposed to know the subtle difference between being a woman and performing one. I said, I'm calling my mother. My brother said, don't. I thought I could get her on the line. I didn't know if it would work. It involved disconnecting the call. It involved dialing her number. It involved reconnecting the call, hoping everyone was still on the line. What I mean is, it involved a certain kind of trust. The metaphor is unintentional. I mean of disconnection. There were many machines in the world all operating at once, all whirring and shaking at once. There are always all these machines in the world whirring and shaking and making it all go. There is always, therefore, the option of disconnection. There is no intentional meaning in this story. I would not subject you to intentional meaning. I would not subject you to some grand scheme. My mother was in Miami, which wasn't where she should have been, but I wasn't where I should have been. No one was, when you think about it. I mean, when you really think about it, I don't mean anything deep about anything deep. I just mean I was confused. And yet I disconnected, pressed some buttons, and there was my mother. And I reconnected, and there we all were. I said, they want me to kill Dad. My mother had left my father 30 years before. There is no reason to go into the details. Suffice it to say, it was his fault. And if that wasn't already clear, as if that wasn't already totally clear, I mean, look at me. Look at my history. I mean, I was not calling my mother because she loved my father. I was not even calling her because she was my mother. I was calling her because she was a nurse. I hoped that because she was a nurse, she would tell me the right thing to do. I'm not talking morally, I'm talking medically. She knew about this. Though, of course, once she was wrong. I mean, once she was dead wrong. I mean, when my ex flatlined the first time. I mean, when she said, he'll never be the same. She was, of course, dead wrong. I mean, he was 100% the same. I mean, he was 100% the same in every way. Impossible, a doctor might have said. Not impossible, I might have said. He was a vegetable going under, a vegetable coming back. But his heart, a doctor might have said. I might have laughed. I might have said something regrettable. My mother said, what? My brother said, tell her. The doctor said, he flatlined. My mother said, you have to kill him. She did not, of course, use these words. I don't know why I'm being so melodramatic. She used technical terms. She said, take him off the respirator. She said, it's the right thing to do. She said, trust me. She said, I need to go, though. She said, I need to get to work. She said, I'm sorry. And because I more often than not do the wrong thing, I said, fine. A few days later, because I was the oldest, because the decision was mine, I would donate my father's body to science. I would do this over the phone, and the conversation would be recorded. A woman would ask me questions I had not before this heard. Do you wish to donate the lungs? Do you wish to donate the heart? There were other organs one doesn't think of. There were other things besides organs. The tissue was to go to the tissue bank. The eyes were to go to the eye bank. There were other things I can't remember. But it was on the eyes. At the thought of the eyes removed from the head, the thought of the eyes going their own way, that I started to cry. This was not about anything deep. I was not suddenly a believer of the soul. I was not suddenly a believer of anything. It was just, think about it. And when I started to cry, the woman said, it's okay, said, let it out. And I stopped crying and sat there, silent. And the recording just went, just recorded my breathing, the woman's breathing, the sounds of static in the phone, and minutes passed. And I thought for some reason of a night years before, me, my father, and my brother, in some fast food place. The fast food place was in a parking lot, and my brother was visiting home from college, and he was sticking his French fries into his milkshake. And I said, sick. And he said, fuck you. And I said, fuck you. And he said, try it, dumbass. And I stuck a French fry into the milkshake, and it was amazing. There was something about the salty and sweet, or the hot and cold. I don't know what it was. My father was poor then, poorer the next day, poorer the next day, poorer the next day, living in some shithole then, like a hostel, like a hospital, like a halfway house. And my brother said he would take him to dinner. Anywhere you want, he said. My father wanted to go to the fast food place. He met us there. He was filthy. His shirt was missing buttons. He ordered 2 cheeseburgers. He ordered onion rings. He ordered an orange soda. He ate too fast, and watching us stick French fries into the milkshake, he said, you're both sick. But then he tried it too, and then he left. And then we ordered more French fries and another milkshake. And what I'm trying to say is, you should try it. What I'm trying to say is, what I'm trying to say is, I did not donate the eyes to the eye bank. At some point, I said, I can't. I don't know why. The parts that didn't go to science were burned. And no, I did not want the ashes. I told the woman to send the ashes to my brother, because my brother was a better person than I was. He was a total asshole, I told the woman, but he was still a better person than I was. I said, he's a total asshole. But in the grand scheme, I said, in the big grand scheme, I said. And I laughed, meaning I really laughed, and the recording went on, and the woman cleared her throat, and I just kept on going. The day the ashes arrived, my brother called me and said, "What the fuck?" And I said, "What?" And he said, "What the fuck?" And I said, "Grow up." There are no more details to tell. There is no reason to go into the why of my father, or the why of madness, which I cannot answer, or the why of addiction, which I also cannot answer, or the why of poor, which I also cannot answer. Suffice it to say, it's always about a loss of something, then a loss of some things, then a loss of all things. Then he was already dead, some might say. "What do you mean?" I might say back. If he had already lost everything, some might say, then he was already dead. "Yes," I might say. "Then you didn't kill him," some might say, as they moved toward me. "That's not the point." "Then what is?" "The doctor said he was sorry for our loss." My brother said, "You did the right thing." Then a lot of serious shit happened in a lot of serious places. My mother drove to work. The doctor flipped a switch. My brother made coffee. The sun rose somewhere, set somewhere else. A brown recluse hunched in the dust. And the truth is, I don't always leave in the mornings. Some mornings, the guy wants to get to work, and so I have to leave. But the truth is, I don't want to. Some mornings, I'm still lying in their beds, and they're like, "You need to leave." And I just lie there, staring at their backs. Some mornings, I note the rib cage. I note the organs seething beneath the rib cage. I note the fragility of what does not, at night, seem fragile. Some mornings, I am not the whore they want me to be. I am not the killer they want me to be. Some mornings, I try to no avail, to absolutely no avail. To no avail, I try, and they get up to make coffee, and I get up and step into my skirt, and I pull on my shirt, and I walk the shortest way home. And the woman performs Happy Woman on a sunny street. The woman performs this, all feels good, this all feels really good. The woman pulls it together. She pulls it tight. She further tightens that which tightens. There were late nights he would call from a payphone, a friend's house, a hospital, a halfway house. And because it was late, and because I was not poor, and because I was not ferociously mad, but rather mad, a machine answered my phone and lied that I wasn't there, eating in bed, watching TV, lied that I would return the call. The machine would then say, "Hello, stranger." The machine would then say, "It's your father, stranger." There were voices in the background. There was traffic in the background. "I'm okay, stranger," the machine would then say. There was screaming in the background. There was me in my bedroom. "Pick up the phone," the machine would say loudly. "I know you're there," the machine would say louder. There was me, turning the TV all the way up. There was every poor soul looking downward. There was me, not believing in the soul. There was me, waiting, counting seconds, staring at the wall. My mother said goodbye and disconnected first. Then the doctor said goodbye and disconnected. After the doctor disconnected, there was silence. But I said, "Hello." I was hoping my brother was still on the line. I wanted to laugh or something. I said hello again, but my brother had disconnected too. And before I ran downstairs to the massive kitchen that was my kitchen, I sat on the edge of my bed, still holding the phone. I imagined the doctor arriving home that morning. I imagined the doctor taking off his scrubs, washing his hands, and climbing into bed with his beautiful wife. I imagined him easing into his wife's heat, the way I once eased into my ex's heat, before we had a sense of what came next, before we had a sense that something came next. Firefighting. Warrensburg, Missouri. Me in my bed, eating cold lo mein. Me eating egg rolls, watching TV. There was no grand scheme. You have to trust me. I would quit my job. I would leave that shithole. I would cross the state line. I would cross another. I would cross another. And here I am now in a different state. And there is the man digging through the trash. And there is the gem buried in the mess. Listen, it was not a shithole. It was not that. Call it what you will, but there were cowboys there, for God's sake, standing on corners in the biggest hats you have ever seen. There were tornadoes that would send you into space. There were spiders that would necrotize your ass. There was a sky turning light, the same sky as everywhere turning light. Call it what you will, but there I was, same as you were, under that sky. There I was, just some poor soul, same as you. That story was called Cowboys. It was written by Susan Steinberg. It was originally published in a periodical called America's Short Fiction. I read it from the Pushcart Prize Anthology, 2012.